Hi, I am Amy Barr, and I am interviewing Jane Gennaro. We are in the Actors Fund in New York City, and it is October 21st, 2019. So, Jane Gennaro, actress, illustrator, artist, voiceover talent, and writer. Tell me a little bit about your family, your childhood, your upbringing, and what influenced you to eventually go into these various fields.
I think that my upbringing and my family is exactly why I'm doing all these things, because I did them all when I was a child. So I grew up, I was born in 1953, and so I think that the culture that you're born in, let's say I was in the womb, all the, I think that everything you do as an artist, or maybe as a person, it's an amalgam of all the things that came before it, like it's within your DNA. So if you play a role, you're Hedda Gabler, maybe you had played something else years ago, and it informs that performance. So I think when I look at the whole picture of performing in the arts, you know, there's this book called Art is an Instinct, and I believe it is. So I think but I think it's things that all mount up on top of each other, and you're absorbing the background. A long way of getting back to where I grew up. So I was born in the Bronx. My parents were both first generation
US.
Of immigrants. Yes, U.S. Mm-hmm. My father Italian, Julius Rudolfo. My mother, mm-hmm. Mary Henry, and their parents both came over from Ireland and Sicily. And my grandmother came over here when she was 17 years old and worked as a maid. You came and you were welcomed by other people who had already immigrated here. My father's mother also came. She was promised in marriage. She turned out she liked another guy better, which was pretty progressive for her. And I like to remember that, because she was a very quiet woman. So I came out of that, and it was after, for them, the time period of the 50s would be after World War II. So the America was very, the economy was going well. The women were now the image, you know, let's say if women were wearing shoulder pads in the 40s, because they were taking over men's jobs and stuff. Once the war was over, they were suddenly wearing shapely, producing children clothes. They were very buxom. That was all about fertility, having them stay home, and getting all these great appliances. So I was born into that world in a town which was very, I would say everything conformed. They were split levels. It would be like Levittown, where after the war these suburban conclaves existed, and they were like, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Miracle on 34th Street.
No.
Okay. Well, she goes to look at the perfect house she might have, you know, that she dreams that she could be in, and it would be that kind of thing. It would really be these new suburbs where all the houses were split levels, all the trees were small. It was a whole new America after the war. And within that was my mother's sensibility in the house that we grew up in. Now, my mother was one of eight children, the oldest of eight children. For her to be married and have her own house and not share a bed. In fact, my parents had twin beds, like Lucy and Rick and Ricky, because she wanted to have her own bed.
Not connected.
No.
Wow.
And in television then, you weren't allowed to have two people in the same bed.
I've never seen something where they did not share a bed.
And
so
you couldn't say the word pregnant.
Wow.
And when Lucy got married on television, you know, I think it was when Eisenhower was elected, and more people were watching the birth, or, you know, the story about the birth of little Ricky than cared about him being elected. But so in that context of that kind of home, my mother was extremely creative, and my mother was a wonderful seamstress, and she had an idea. It was about being, you know, you wanted to look like you had money, and my mother was able to look at Vogue patterns and kind of, even if she couldn't afford the Vogue pattern, copy it and make it looked like it was a Vogue pattern. She would tell you, I have taste and style. And we all looked smart. So all the girls were wearing, you know, maybe the same blue, and I'm talking about the baby too, blue wool, navy blue wool suits, double-breasted mother-of-pearl buttons. You know, four of us, including the little baby. We all looked sensational all the time. We would have preferred maybe to look more frilly, but, and then my mother could, she could upholster, she could make her own curtains, she loved baking. All these things were part of what a woman did. My mother happened to have, I think of the women who, like, got stuck in that and didn't have the desire or talent for it, you know, and there were a lot of them, and that's why also tranquilizers were very big then. So when women were kind of now being fit into that image of what a woman should be, reproduce, be fertile, make more Americans, that's what created the baby boom. You know, women were just pushed into that position. My mother thrived in it because it was very creative. She had her own home. We grew up listening to the popular culture at the time. Would be like you would, the great playwrights were, or the modern playwrights were on television. So you could have, you know, Patty Chayefsky, Marty was on television, or there was Playwright, Playhouse something, you know, where the playwrights were there. People were going to musicals. The general population, you didn't have to have a lot of money. So those things were playing in our house, you know, and my parents were very interested. And at that time, people went to listen to orchestras. There was a big crowd going to hear the Philharmonic. So my house was full of music and the albums, plus the popular culture of the time, you know. And at that time, it was also, people think of it at the 50s as poodle skirts and Elvis and Marilyn. But there was also another thing going on. You know, it was very conservative. It was very safe because the bomb, because the hydrogen bomb had, like, come out in 1950. So when I was a kid, we were hiding under our desks. We'd have air raid drills in case the bomb dropped. There was a lot of, you know, it was the Korean War before me. So that was meant that North Korea was invading South Korea, and there was the communist threat. And then China came and took, you know, came over, and there became communist China and Czechoslovakia. They were all communists now. So there was a big fear of communism, of the bomb, and that informed a lot of what was going on. So it became a religious time. The Bible was the top-selling book. And so there was one level of real conformity and conservatism. And on the other side of it, there was Jackson Pollock. There was Louise Bourgeois, one of my favorite sculptures. There was Arthur Miller coming out with The Crucible to talk about McCarthyism. So the whole picture of it, you know, that all surrounds whatever I was doing as a little girl.
No, that makes sense. I'm wondering what ignited in you to start being a creative, though, other than it being present in your household. What gave you the confidence to feel like you had something that was worthy of being heard? Was that your parents?
Well, I wanted to be heard. I was one of six children, so I really wanted attention. Okay. And also, I came from a background like the Irish side. They were all singing. We would get together and have big parties, and there was a lot of singing going on. There was always performing, and part of the attention, because I was directing the living room plays in my house. So my cousins would come over, and let's say and there was a lot of attention from my parents and applause for performance and art. And, you know, a lot of people have the opposite experience. Their parents want them to be scholars, you know.
That's what makes me curious. Like, how does one foster in a child that these creative ideas are important?
Well, it was absolute. I mean, I think my mother thought of herself as a creative person, and I think she didn't have a lot of, you know, she was in the church shows with her sister singing, and she skipped many grades, but she was, her mother would say, spare me from a woman who goes to college. So my mother, wasn't going to go along the educational, I don't think, that didn't become important in our house. So, I mean, you were expected to do well. I wouldn't say I did, although some of my siblings did, but it was really about, it was easy to perform, and, you know, here are my kids, and aren't they good looking, and don't they sing well, and, you know, and inviting all the relatives to come see us in the chorus. You know, all of my siblings, we were always like the stars of our high school plays. We sat around drawing, having drawing contests, which one is best? It was all like that. If you came into my house, everyone played an instrument. It was constantly these, and we entertained ourselves. So, you know, there were a lot of us, so that we were responsible for entertaining ourselves, and that entertainment became something that we brought to our parents to get, you know, to get their approval, I think, to be, you know, maybe too Freudian about it. But we loved doing it. So, you know, it was to sit around drawing, and there were limits on what you could watch, for, you know, so much television. All the television I watched, all those commercials, all those things, I look back now and go, boy, I ended up being a perky mom doing television commercials years later. But, I mean, I remember being, wherever I was, it was going to be showtime. So I had an imaginary show called Toilet Time whenever I went and sat on the pot. And I was the host of my show talking to guests. Or I had, you know, Snow Queen when I was in the bath, you know, with bubbles. And my sister and I would imitate Comet commercials. You know, my mother preferred Comet to Ajax, so she would be Rita, who used Ajax, and I'd be like, I'm using Comet, Rita. Your cleanser doesn't work well. And we were little kids! You know? So the whole popular culture, we were always that, we were just like that, the whole family. We were all like that, and we were encouraged. So I would say, yeah, my parents enjoyed it.
No, that makes a lot of sense how you are where you are today, I think. Yeah, because a lot of people would not have had that upbringing, I think. So I'm very glad that you did.
Well, thank you. And it was without that kind of pressure, like, you better do, you know, it wasn't like Tiger Mom pressure, like, play your cello and get, you know, get the best rating. I mean, it was, yes, play your cello, and if we can afford to get you private lessons, we'll do that, or you might be with a college student. You know, I mean, my mother, I think, wanted us to have those opportunities that she, you know, she would never say she really wanted things that she didn't get. But her creativity, costumes for shows, for the costumes we wore on Halloween, the things she made. She would take one of my father's shirts. This was always the costume. Take Dad's shirt that he's not wearing anymore, put it on backwards, cut something out of it, and suddenly you're a flapper, you know. And flappers came out of her aunt's era. You know, my mother was born in 1926. So, and I remember going into school with my flapper, you know. She would, like, find this little cloche. The costume didn't exist without my mother wrapping it around on you. So it wasn't like she sewed it. It was like she designed it on you. And so I remember going to school, and there were the long beads, and she had done my makeup, and then here used a cigarette holder, and then I got there, and Mrs. Skolnick, my teacher, we were doing the costume parade, she's like, when you get up there, do the Charleston. I'm like, what's the Charleston? And she showed me this little dance. And so when I got up, I did the Charleston, and I won first prize for being a flapper. You know, and I remember a year later, you couldn't go home and get your costume put on you. You couldn't go home for lunch, which is what I always did, and my mother would make me into this thing. So she gave me all the elements to be a queen. And it was like the first time I lost, because once I had to put them on, you know, it was like using a fake, you know, toy mink stole was suddenly going to be the collar of the cape. And there were all of these elements, but I didn't really know how to put them together in the right way. You know, but years before, we were gypsies. And, it, you know, it, she was just very, very creative in that way. And that informed everything when I look back now. You know, how she hung a Christmas tree, how I'm doing working with sculptures, how I'm... these things I remember her saying. If you make a flower arrangement you know, it should be two-thirds as high as the bottom of it. You know, well, who would think this? Or she would play with my dollhouse. It would piss me off. I'd have all the furniture stuck on the side walls, and she'd be like, no, you have to do little arrangements. So there was all of that, her sensibility going on. And then the performing thing, which was me, you know, getting all the kids together, writing plays for our cousins. I still have one of them. Our neighbors, the Eberts, had they were old. And when we moved into Rockville Center, which was not Plainview, which was like the Levittown kind of thing, Rockville Center was an old town, we found this old Victrola on the street. And it was a record cabinet and had the big old horn with a whatever you call that. And in it were all these old records, 78s. And I remember you'd wind up the turntable. And my mother wouldn't let us keep the horn. But for years we had that record cabinet and played the song. So I heard, you know, Ella Mae Morris singing Cow Cow Boogies. Years later, my sisters and I, those Gennaro sisters, we were singing that song. There was a song called Whistling Rufus. There was, you know, Frank Sinatra, I'm Just a Fella. And this was all like so before our time, but we always were putting on a show. I always like take those songs, and then I wrote a play around it. It was called Those Happy Days, and basically it was like playing the record in between two lines of dialogue. There was one record called Titania, some German record. And I'd be like, okay, Ellen, my sister, you're Titania, and I'm Mrs. Green, or something. I mean, it would be like, and then we just played a record.
So it sounds like this was all very much happening inside the home, though, for a good period of time. Can you tell me about when you first began seeing it as like a career path? This act of performing arts, and maybe the first show you were in, the first anything that took it outside of performing at home, and it became like, this is what I think I want to do with my life.
Well, it started in school.
Okay.
So then, you know, I mean, I remember in various ways with each teacher, let's say, you know, things that I was drawing, things that I was performing, and for instance, in fourth grade, I had this teacher, Mr. Ward, who looked like Alfred Hitchcock kind of meets like Kris Kringle. I mean, and Mr. Ward would say there are six senses, not like extrasensory perception. His sixth sense was the sense of tinkle. So that meant you knew you had to go to the bathroom. And Mr. Ward would say, when you get to the bathroom, be careful, you know, because alligators and rats can come out of the toilet bowl. And, well, kids, we loved this. And he later got fired, of course. But Mr. Ward also decided that I was a good enough artist to do the whole billboard for February myself. So I did, like, a silhouette of Lincoln and Washington looking at each other. And then on the sides were all these hearts and little animal couples and stuff. And parents came up to school, and they were, where is my child's art? So I love Mr. Ward, and one day he said, you have a nice voice. Would you get up and sing for us? And I was shy in school at that point. But my sister had been in, like, The King and I in kindergarten, and I knew the song Whistle a Happy Tune, which is Whenever I Feel Afraid, I Hold My Head. And that I thought I sang that in front of the class. And the whistling part, I had to go, hoo, 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 because I didn't know how to whistle. So I would say Mr. Ward in fourth grade suddenly made me feel like recognized outside of my home. But I don't even know why. I mean, I think, I don't know why. And then by the time I was in sixth grade, I was feeling my oats. And our teacher, Miss Kowalski, would have performance day. And, you know, like the smartest kids would leave to go to some special class with Miss Dobie. And then the rest of us, to make it special for us, she would say, okay, do a performance. And I remember this kid doing Billy Bloodgood. He's like sang the Beatles, and he wore this wig, and, you know, I want to hold your hand. And the class is roaring. They think it's so funny. And I'm saying to myself, well, I could do better than that. So I go home and I'm looking through our books, like Reader's Digest condensed books, or, you know, and I find this Robert Browning, A Lover's Quarrel. And I decided to be like, you know, the dramatic actress. Oh, what the dawn of day, how the March sun feels like May. All is blue again after last night's rain. And I'm talking like that in sixth grade. And I always used to feel like people think I'm really weird. But anyway, that was my performance. And so but the class really liked it. And there again, my teacher, you know, the next week I decided I'd do a funny one. So I cut out this shower stall and I brought in water and I poured it on my head and I stuck up my head and I was pretending I was doing a shampoo commercial for Head and Shoulders. You know, and then I look later and I'm like, you're doing this commercial. So I would say in school, in those years, I knew I wanted to perform and I felt like I was the star and I was getting star parts. So, but then when I got to seventh grade, I was like a smaller body size and I was flat and it was seventh, eighth and ninth graders. And I remember feeling this whole loss of my big sixth grade identity, you know. In sixth grade, I was the funny one, I was the comedian, I gave the fair, you know, the funny speech at the end, and I did all these voices, and I was doing this comics with my girlfriends. I brought them here to show you them. It's all of them, these comics, we'd pass them back and forth, and they would all be like, you know, you draw your girl, I'll draw my girl. And in the end, they'd always get the guy. And then, like, later, my sister and I did, like, now we're going to do a really good comic. And then, like, you can see through the years where we did these things that became our things that we were doing. So I was doing these art comics, and I was at the top of my game in sixth grade.
Yeah.
And then it all fell apart.
And you think being flat had something to do with that.
I think it had to do with being in a bigger pond.
Right.
And feeling like there were grown-up girls there, and suddenly, and I remember a teacher who said to me, Mr. Cooney, he said, Gennaro, you're a ham. I remember trying out for a play, it was going to be like a takeoff on 007. And of course, at the audition, I made everyone laugh. And he didn't like me. And he didn't like me being a ham, and he didn't let me be in the show. And then I remember I did it, but I tried out for the talent show, and I sang Matchmaker, and our dog died the night before. Samson ran out in the street. He died in my arms, this beautiful Cocker Spaniel, one trickle of blood. And I was crying all night, but the show must go on, so I, like, got out of the talent show and sang Matchmaker, and at the highest note, I cracked. And I thought, you know, that's my tragedy. That's my tragedy right there. So I realized that if I wasn't going to be in the thing that I had to be cast for, and this became a theme in my life with my career, I'll do my own thing. I can get up in the talent show and I can sing. You know, no, everyone can be in the talent show. So I would say it had a lot to do with teachers. Growing up, that early on I didn't know that I was going to, I was kind of torn. I thought I might be a veterinarian or a nun at one point in seventh grade, you know, and I had a lot of the pageantry of the Catholic religion was very, very profound for me, and that was a performance. So when you had your first Holy Communion, it was a performance. You know, you were in a pageant, and all of that was being, there was something beautiful, and the church really always was, you know, it was from like old ritualistic behavior, you know, when you look at ancient times and they were making music and the rituals then became the church rituals and it carries on, but it was the first form of theater really. So I think that theater background, the churchy background, then that was there. But the teachers that encouraged me and gave me a chance, then I felt like I would be an actress by the end. I had a plan. I was going to go to college, and you didn't really have, my marks were not good. In fact, for the SAT for math, I maybe tried 10 samples, and then I realized, this is beyond me. And so I just randomly marked in the things, and it showed, too. So there were a couple of states, Fredonia State School took me, and they happened to have a great theater department and a great music department. And so there I was, it was very funny, because in one hand I was in the cool theater crowd with a big crush on my teacher, Joe Guastafaro, and we were doing this Commedia dell'arte. Mary McDonald was in my class. She was had been a cheer. You know, it's funny where you see who what your identity had been, and then you're in the theater department. Well, I was the only one in the theater department who also thought it would be a good idea to enter the Miss Dunkirk Fredonia pageant. And, you know, that means bathing suit competition. They were all kind of mortified.
For you.
Yes. Like, Jane is doing that, you know. And on the other hand, I was in the Commedia dell'arte. I'm playing the ingenue, but I'm kind of making fun of being the ingenue. I'm looking up all these... Rod McEwen, he was the poet then, like the cheesy kind of listen to the warm poet. And so I was using all his lines as a satire, as my part. You kind of wrote your own part. So... I left Fredonia because I was thinking my sister Ellen was having more fun at Cortland State. In the meantime, at Fredonia, I also, you know, I had done these plays, and it was really a good theater school. And then when I went to Cortland, I did theater there. And then I flunked myself out because I wanted to be in the city, and I wanted to start my career. And so, and I knew that if I didn't flunk myself out, my parents would make me continue. But now there was no way of continuing. Now it was like, you're not going back. And my plan was, you know, I wanted to be professional. So I happened to find a roommate, Allison Ford, who I went to high school with, who later became a set designer. And we met on the railroad, Long Island Railroad, one day. I was commuting back and forth. I had this job at a place called Famous Music, which started out my whole career in every way. I mean, I was not qualified to do anything, and this very nice... There were employment agencies. Do they still have those?
Yes. Not that I have ever experienced in my real life, but I know that they exist.
So they're not just online. You'd actually meet a person?
I believe it's more now for people who are, like, low income, helping them... I don't know if... I wouldn't know where to go, personally, if that was something that I had to do. I would go through school.
Right.
Like the career counselors at
school. Yeah.
But I don't know if, like,
just a
place.
This was very different then. There were, you know, employment agencies, and you would go and you'd take a typing test. Ah! Terrible typist. Terrible everything. I had no skills. I had no skills except the particular things I could do. I could entertain. I could draw. I could, you know, all the things that I... that ended up being my career. But they were really kind of what I did and didn't have other good skills.
And they were trying to pinpoint what
could
be used in the workforce.
Well, they wanted to get you a job. So, I would go in with my little rapidograph drawings. I had done all these drawings through high school with a rapidograph. And they were drawings of groups of people. And my teacher, Bill Dane, encouraged me. I illustrated the whole yearbook that way. And when I look back at them now, they're kind of like, it's as if you're part of a whole group. And they're very organic. They kind of flow, and they flowed across the pages of the yearbook. And they would be the dividers. So here are all the athletes, or here are the cheerleaders, or here's the drama club, or here's the art club, or here's the gymnastics club. And they would be these drawings with a rapidograph, which is a thin pointed, it's a technical pen, really. So it's just, it doesn't have any, you know, it stays one width. And so I had started doing those drawings, and when I look back at them now, they were full of characters. All these different personalities. And my teacher was like, stick with those drawings. That's really your own, it's very much your own style, and use that. That will take you places. So, when I look back at these drawings now, they're kind of amazing to me, because one might be all these movie stars on a 1930s set. One might be at the airport. One might be at a singles bar. And so that was my skill. So when I went for a job, I would say, well, here are my drawings. You know, I didn't even know enough to, like, be looking for an art job. So I was at, you know, my parents were always like, my mother was a secretary. Get a job that pays the rent. And so there was not that kind of direction of a career, obviously. So I remember meeting this very nice guy, and he goes, you seem like a very nice person, and you're very funny, and, you know, but you really have no skills. But I'm going to, you know, and you failed your typing test here, but I'm going to keep you in mind, and your drawings are very nice. And he called up weeks later, and he said, I have something I think is perfect for you. And I said, what? He goes, it's a receptionist at a company called Famous Music. Now, Famous Music, it was a publishing company and a record company, and it was in the Gulf and Western building, which is now the Trump Tower on 23rd Street at Columbus Circle. And, you know, it was a job in a record company. So he's like, you know, you're perfect for it. So I went with my, you know, my big boobs, which I had at the time, and my platform heels, and my little mini skirt, and my floppy fedora hat, and of course a jacket to cover the boobs, but, you know, looking like Groovy Girl. And the job was, there was a jukebox out front, and I just had to answer phones, and it was all, you know, like push-button phone, and, you know, hello, this is Famous Music, who would you like, and remember, see who, you know, even that was a little, was difficult for me. But right in front of us was this jukebox in the hallway, and the halls were like all these, you know, rainbow colors, groovy, discotechy kind of thing. And the people that worked there were, you know, they were record business people. So I was the face of Famous Music, and I would sit there when I wasn't on the phone with my drawing book, just drawing my Rapidograph people. And I had in my mind that I would, my plan when I moved into the city was that I would support myself as an artist so that I could make it as an actor. That was my plan.
Your main goal was acting at that time.
Yeah, but it was both. You know, that the art, which was also a very unrealistic goal. So, of course, I ended up as a singing waitress. But which is how I met my friend Sarah Krieger, who introduced me to the whole Actors Fund thing. We were at this place called Once Upon a Stove. And we were, you know, singing waitresses. So you'd serve the food, and then you'd get up and sing a song. But out of Famous Music came all these opportunities.
So that was your starting point outside of school.
Outside of school. And I was 20 years old, and I was at the front desk, and they did in-house voiceovers. I didn't know what a voiceover was. There again, someone said, you have a nice voice. Would you like to try and do one of our spots? And there was a little recording studio, and it was like, so I announced a spot. So that was like, where's this from? There was this guy, Peter Sandifer. He was the engineer guy. And at the same time, I was doing these drawings. And also they were, and I was madly in love with Al Pacino. And Famous Music later, oh, that's another story. But Famous Music, they got bought by Paramount Pictures. And then those people were in the building, like Al Pacino. And everybody knew I had such a crush on him. They'd be like, Jane, he's getting on the elevator. And I remember, like, getting on the 23rd floor. I get on the elevator, and there's Al Pacino, and I'm there in, like, my platform shoes and big boobs, towering over him. This man in, like, a cap pulled over his head and his raincoat, like he's going to kill people, like one of these, like, post office people who, like, live in a raincoat, like, and then go shoot people or something. Or you could be like Henry Darger and just live in your raincoat and be doing all these drawings. But, yeah, I said, I'm here to meet you. And he said, oh, did Francis send you, like Francis Ford Coppola? And I was like, no, I'm just here to meet you. And then he got really even shorter and sunk into the corner, and I scared him so much. And then I would see him all the time on the street. And I heard he was interviewed, and I would see him, and I'd go, hi. I was like a stalker. I just kept running into him. And I wanted to marry him, and that was going to save my life. I was going to marry Al Pacino, and Serpico was out then, when I was first there. I bought the album. I was obsessed with him. I was obsessed with him.
That's interesting that you thought that he was going to save your life. Was that still a thing, like women are not as well?
Yes, and when you look at all these comics, the sixth grade comics, each one ends in that same way.
A man
is saving the your day. Life. And I have to say, for me, at that time, I was going out with older men. At Famous Music, many things happened. Many people walked in. I mean, from getting my first drawings published, there was a little old man who came in, Mr. Tibor. He sold chocolates. He made them, and they were chocolate-covered strawberries and stuff. And he would go to all of the music companies, all the Broadway shows, and he would limp in, Mr. Tibor, and everyone would come out of their office and buy Tibor's chocolates. And he saw me drawing, and he said, "Oh, well, you know, I have a friend over at Chapel Music, and he's the art director." And he sent me over to the art director, and I illustrated 3 books at Chapel Music. Those were my first art jobs. I was sitting, you know, with my rapidograph drawings, and then I was sitting there, one of the guys in the Famous Music, his wife was doing an educational book. He goes, "You know, your drawings might be good for my wife's book." That was actually the very first one I did. It was called Help. And it was all the little spot drawings and this educational book. And then the drawings for this other thing. And then I started getting little jobs. I started getting a portfolio together. It was all because of Famous Music.
What do you say that he's one of the people giving you the job at Famous Music that...
Yes. And I wish I remember his name. Glenn something. He was very handsome.
But he really...
He got it. He got me.
He saw that you had something that
Yes, and he knew where
used.
To put me. And that there was such a place for me to be put. And that the people there, it was a different mindset. It was, you know, I had worked in horrible other offices. Always not good at the job, and they were painful. Painful because I didn't want to be there. Also painful because I couldn't seem to get the hang of the job. But here, so it was all going very well until one day I got all in a flustered with too many phone calls, and I picked up the phone and I go, "Oh, shit," and I hung up. And then the president of the company, his name was Martel, very, very lovely man, his secretary said, "Mr. Martel would like to see you." And he goes, "I just called, and you picked up the phone and said, 'Oh, shit.'" I think it probably was. Yeah.
That's terrible luck.
It was horrible. I was like, "Oh my God." You know, he was so nice, Tony Martel. And, you know, he let me stay on. But even that job, I wasn't very good at. But I had a big crush on the art director, Bill Levy. And he would let me, you know, order things because I was a company, you know, employee, so I could order things through them with it. I wanted to be the art assistant, but that job was taken. But then, you know, then when Paramount took over, you'd hear about these auditions. I remember auditioning for The Godfather, being in that first thing where you're like in a cattle call. Didn't know what a cattle call was, you know, and suddenly there was a cattle call. When I look back at my old journals, which I started keeping at that time, and I can, these auditions and these, backstage, getting your audition. One of my friends from high school who thought I was the greatest thing was like, "They're doing Hair again." And I remember auditioning for Hair and not getting in Hair, you know, and he like, "Well, I have a job for you. You can paint the signs for the protest scene." So I'm actually in the Hair. It's like my only Playbill credit. You know, signs in protest scene or whatever.
It counts.
Yeah, it counted to me.
Yeah. So these sound like a lot of overall wins and little successes, but how did you deal with a particular failure? What was a failure that while you were finding yourself in this career or various careers made you possibly second guess what you were doing?
Well, I felt like I had a lot of failures. I felt like every audition that I didn't get was a failure. I felt like I was, you know, in a big world. I mean, I was getting these little art jobs, and that was all good. You know, in terms, I remember big disappointments. Something I thought would happen, and then it didn't happen. You know, and that goes back to even childhood, when in eighth grade we were going to do Annie Get Your Gun, and I was going to be one of the Annies, and suddenly that wasn't going to happen. Or we were in the neighborhood, and we all planned a big show like, you know, Judy and Mickey, and suddenly for some reason we weren't allowed to do it in our neighborhood. Or the hula hoop contest in the 50s, you know, where everyone got their hula hoop, and suddenly it was canceled. So that feeling of disappointment, and then there's the feeling of disappointment and rejection. And I remember, and to this day, I always feel like I did something wrong if I didn't get the thing. And it's a very childhood Catholic kind of feeling. But I would say, you know, those kind of things where my friend Steven Susskind, he was working for, the famous producer, I can't think of his name now, David Merrick. And, you know, I'm not sure if David Merrick was, whoever was doing that revival of Hair, Steven got me in on the audition, and I heard these other people sing, and I was, this kind of talent, this kind of extremely unbelievable voices, I didn't have a voice like that, I was a comedian, I sang, so that kind of thing, like Grease, I remember auditioning for Grease and getting a couple of callbacks. And it was a good, it would be a good role for me. It was Rizzo, you know, and not getting that. Those things were so devastating to me. And so I questioned that I could, be the star I thought I was in high school, or ever have those feelings again, those wonderful performances in high school. Mm. Or in the college play, you know, we did Company, and all those things I could do, and I knew I could do, but in this big picture, maybe I couldn't. So what I have always done is go back to making something happen myself. And so that started when I was working for my friend Barbara Slate, drawing these greeting cards, Ms. Liz, and...
I remember you showed me them. They were incredible.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. The woman who speaks her mind. And when we get into our later conversation about fashion and body image...
I can't wait.
Yeah, because we'll go into that.
Yes.
But Barbara was also somebody who fixed me up a lot. She fixed me up with this guy, Jack. He was a lawyer. We went to the comic strip, and I saw these performers. I remember seeing Carol Leifer, Nancy Parker, who did impressions. And I was just starting to realize I could do impressions and characters. And I thought, I'm gonna audition, because then I could cast myself. And so that's where I started this 7-year career as a stand-up comedian, very much doing characters, doing my own writing. So it was when I realized, and generally in life, where, you know, if they don't want me, or if I can't fit into the... And I feel like I could fit in.
To the mold.
I should fit in. Mm. I don't even mean to the mold. I mean just to the opportunities. Like, But I don't get that opportunity. I really just started making... And at that time in the 80s, stand-up was such a great showcase. It was really... That was the era to be a stand-up. I mean, my era that I came into... although I'm a little older than some of these people by a couple of years, but they were in it longer, were like Jerry Seinfeld and Paul Reiser and Larry Miller and you know, Gilbert Gottfried and Larry David and, you know, all of those guys, Bill Maher, Jay Leno. In fact, when I started doing stand-up, there's this magazine, Attenzione, and I'm on the page there with Jay Leno and Pat Cooper and Jane Gennaro. It was 1979, and it was like the first Italian American comedian, you know. That was Will. They could very well be.
Wow.
You know. So, but by Jay Leno was already, you know, very successful, as was Jerry Seinfeld. They were already very successful working comedians all over, making money. But everyone was at the clubs, you know, and
So it was a long, painful process till I finally got the kind of act. I mean, when they did that article, she may be the first Italian. I had a really bad act. Really bad. You know. A few funny lines, which I can't think of. Maybe they weren't that funny. But you know, but I remember someone reading that article and coming down to see me and him going, you know, you have no act. And it was just an article that happened to be, you know, I fit into what that guy was writing. You know, I had some funny lines. I was doing some impressions. I was doing Miss America. I can look back and see what, you know, I'm not somebody who remembers all my lines, obviously. But it was still, it was a way of finding my own place, you know. And women weren't that, I mean, I have all my old things. Who was around? Who was doing stuff at that time? Women were still not really, you know, the big deal.
Oh, yeah, you only named men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there were women around, and there was a wonderful comedian named Elaine Boozler. She was great. And then my peers were Joy Behar, Susie Essman, Carol Leifer. And I remember I was on the Today Show with Jane Pauley, and they had this feature called Future Stars of Tomorrow. And it was Joy Behar and me and this guy, John Mendoza. So Joy is the one who became the star. But it was still not that common. I mean, there were women around, and Susie Essman was also, she was doing characters, so there were more of us. But it was still not Rita Rudner. You know, she went to my voice teacher, and I remember the first time she came to a club because she was a Broadway actress. Because my voice teacher came, she was interested. You know. Oh, Jane's doing stand-up, let's go see. And then she really had this wonderful career. But it wasn't that common, you know. And then when I finally had an act that... I started doing an act in the 80s when MTV came out. MTV was then just playing music videos. And when it first came out, there were no black artists on it. That came later. And they had VJs, video jocks. And I remember auditioning to be a video jock. That was a very big disappointment when I didn't get that. I thought, I'm perfect for this. But it also seemed to me that it was... it annoyed me to have that you were looking at the music and not hearing it, and now suddenly there's a story imposed on it, these music videos. And that there were... I just felt like the acts. You know, I always felt like rock and roll. I always thought music was rock and roll would be, you know, subversive, or it's the rebel thing. And then I just felt like, you know, the acts are selling out when they're doing this, because really what MTV is a commercial. So I started doing an act in the club, which was, I said, well, you know, they're all kind of selling out, so why don't they just do commercials? And then I would like take the hit of whoever was there, you know, like Tina Turner, What's Love Got to Do with It? And suddenly I'm going, What's Dove got to do with it? And I'm wearing these big yellow, you know, rubber gloves to wash my dishes with. Or I was doing Prince for for feminine protection. Instead of Purple Rain, it was Purple Stain. I was Madonna, she had the song Borderline, so I would be like wearing a pantyhose on my head and being like, panty line, seems like they're strangling my behind. And I worked with a band, and this act became a big hit. And so that started getting me attention, so that's why I was on the Today Show. And then Rodney Dangerfield comes, and wants me to be at his club. And Rodney Dangerfield's was always the scariest dark club. It just felt like, you know, the mob was there. And it was dark, and it wasn't exactly like the kind of audience that I felt would necessarily know David Bowie. Or plus, I couldn't do the band, but he was going to be doing a special, and they were considering having me in the special. So this was a big disappointment. I started playing that club, which was very hard for me because it wasn't with a band. It wasn't the right thing. Meanwhile, I'd be killing a Catch a Rising Star. That was great with the band. Fun, great time. Finally got to be like an A act. And then I'd be doing my, you know, my whatever you had to do. Penance or something. Not penance. It was like just to get on this special. And then it turned out that I wasn't going to be on the special because they didn't want to have to get the rights to all those songs, you know, to real songs and stuff. And so that was a big thing where I suddenly felt that's where it was such a big disappointment that I started moving away from stand-up comedy. Mm. And started moving away from that act.
So in your work, from the beginning until now, are there any key principles or themes around which you seem to keep coming back to?
There are definite themes. I would say, let's start with the themes then. Okay. The themes are how the individual fits in with the larger picture. Body image is a theme. Nature is a theme. The commercial versus the artistic is a theme. And the principle would be truth. And I base, since I haven't been fortunate enough to be cast by other people a lot, and since I basically am a self-made, I mean, I create my own vehicles. So within that, which is a wonderful thing, is each, it has a set of rules, and I don't know that you can always exactly say what they are, but you have to stick to them, whatever rules you make up. But the overall rule for every artist is honesty and truthfulness. You know, most things are an attempt to make sense of the world and to make a comment. So I would say the principle is to, it's to pursue trying to understand, investigate, explore how you feel about things, the larger picture, how you feel about the society that you live in. And to try and find, to distill that into something that you can work with. I don't like it. I don't like that. I don't like the way they're treating women. I don't like the way they make us look. I don't like what they're doing to the environment. I don't like that everything has to be about making money. I don't like that I'm not getting enough attention. What does attention mean? What does fame mean? You know, so if you have these feelings that are always there, then I feel like the principle that you're here to learn, you know, and so what can I learn, you know, so I think that if I were to talk about things that are good to always have in the top of your mind is it really true? Where did you get the idea from? You know, because we all copy, and that's how we learn. And I certainly, in my career, you know, we copy other people's drawings. That's how you learn. You copy the classical people. You copy. I did impressions for years, so I was copying people. And you're copying your parents. We're all copying. That's how we all learn. But then, what's the next step? Okay, I get how we all behave. Do I have to behave this way? What do I really think? And if these things are bothering me, can I be honest about it? And can I understand what is it? And if it is offensive, unfair, hateful, then what can I do about that? What do I have to say about it? Am I willing to make the effort to say it and to stick with trying to keep clarifying what my message is? So